gentlemen, and whatever else you got. I'm Layman Pascal on the Integral Stage with another episode of our Soul of AI series, trying to fold in more diverse and outsider perspectives so we can do a richer, more multidimensional sense-making on the rise of the new quasi-intelligences. Today we're diving in with Chris Beasley, who, in addition to being a cat wrangler, painter, visionary, and electronic artist, has a rich background in understanding digital systems and the deficiencies in how they're being deployed. She led a successful redesign of Firefox support, created a sustainable AI company, got between Sequoia Capital and a doomed AI venture, and has been featured in the cover story of The Atlantic magazine, for whatever that's worth. Now she's the regenerative AI strategy advisor at earthcodes.org, overseeing their regenerative data cycles project, AI for Gaia, in partnership with the Biomimicry Institute. Hi, Chris.
Oh my God, there's some hilarious grace. I just discovered that HERS director is Spike Jones, not Spike Lee, and he's a white man, and I was talking about diversity. Oh God. I don't know how we clean this fucking shit up. I don't know what to do about this. I don't know if it can be edited out. Well, let me know what you think.
This is Chris Beasley, and I read on the internet she's a regenerative AI strategy advisor at Earth Codes Observatory. What is that? What is Earth Codes Observatory?
Earth Codes, oh Lord. Earth Codes started as something completely different. I was hired by them to create an immersive experience of a vision of the future that would motivate people to hunger for the sea, to hunger for the vision that's ahead, because they can maybe not touch it, but they can see it. So we were, think like Meow Wolf, if it really was about downloading the current codes of a vision of Earth that's actually sustainable and thriving for everyone and feeding the children of everyone. Like, can we see it? Can we see it before we can touch it? So that's what it started as, but then pandemic and having an in-person space to do anything, like the VR goggles already had sanitation concerns about them. So that completely went away. This was located in the former Stanford Medical Library in San Francisco. So we had this epic space. I mean, this, can you just taste how delicious this project was going to be? So I got called in to do that. And that was not the thing. So we put on our hard hats and went, all right, what is ours to do? Not what is needed, because infinite things are needed that you would love to think about doing, but what is ours to do? And what felt the most resonant was being the commons maker for the data, because we've got a lot of data that hasn't been modeled at all, a lot of source data, and then models themselves eventually will get created, but out of what data? The data that it's being trained on is predominantly white, educated, industrialized, rich. What's the D in the weird? Do you know which one? I'm quoting a model that critiques a lot of RCTs because they are usually done on white, educated, industrialized beings. And then that gets generalized as if those findings can be generalized to other populations. So that's happening right now with our data as well. And Earth Codes is there to actually create a data commons so that if you as a developer, or we're so close to citizen trained GPTs, but on what data, and can we do some of the shittier parts about cleaning the data, which is a really difficult task? Can we do that in such a way that it only has to be done once, you know? So these are the missions of Earth Codes. As a big tilt to indigenous data, the executive director has a deep relationship and personal mission to see this serve indigenous communities. So that's a little bit about it.
So that seems, on the one hand, desperately necessary that we rebalance and curate the data set that these things are training on so that we're not averaging out a sensibility that represents only one subset of the population. But at the same time, it sounds dangerous to try to go in and deliberately counterbalance that, because how do you know when which things to take into account? What are the categories, and where are you placing your finger on the scale? So how do you make those determinations?
Well, that's a large part of why the indigenous wisdom is so needed, because there is no tragedy of the common in societies which teach their children to not create that reality. Like harvest traditions, the way in which you respect the resource, you do not have an orientation of harvest as extraction. There's always a reciprocity with the land. And if we do not incorporate those principles into AI, it will continue the corporate sovereignty or corporate, what do I want to call it? I feel like I'm making up a new word. What would we call this? Corporate in sovereignty that we are currently in, aka the matrix, the simulation. What do we call that? Doesn't it need a new word? Corporate in sovereignty doesn't have much of a ring to it. I refuse to call it
No.
reality because that enshrines it.
What about Moloch? People try to like personify the system as an ancient
it.
demon.
I never would have. Tell me more about Moloch. I feel like he's a bad dude that's made out of clay and lives
It's like
in.
a I don't know, one of those Old Testament terms, but it's been used by people like Daniel Schmachtenberger and stuff in the last year or two to sort of embody and instantiate game A dynamics. But it's
Got it.
fun
Okay,
because
good.
it gives you a sense of the egregoric agency and also the
Oh,
demonic flavor
I've
of the
got
thing
one of
we're embedded
these.
in.
I got a drawing of this one. Aha, it's right here. I drew this one, you think? Does that look about right?
Yep, it's both scary and mysteriously empty and homogeneous.
Okay, and then look at it from this direction. It's supposed to look very different. Does it look different to you? This is gonna be really fun for the podcast, isn't it? Isn't it?
That's right. Maybe we should describe this for people who are just
I'll be
listening.
your
Ah,
assistant.
to hell with them.
Okay.
We've got like a big blob-like ghost on one half, and it's kind of the vertical reflection of what looks like a human being with pointy hands and feet.
So my
And
intention was.
I'm really noting the pointiness too, as if this person is stabbing the earth by standing on it.
I'm just not good at drawing hands. So we went with the clothespin man. But the other side, it is more finely rendered and has three picks instead of one pick. But the intention is that this looks like the figure, and this looks like the reflection. And then when you see it the other way around, and you see this is the shadow that's just being cast. It makes me feel less scared of the boogeyman. It makes me feel like I can walk around my house at night and maybe even like stare in mirrors, which I'm still freaked out by staring in mirrors. I watched that movie when I was too little.
I heard what I thought was an interesting thing in one of your previous comments there, like as if we need to use a more indigenous approach when it comes to harvesting data itself. And what's the essence of that approach? How is that distinguished from the dominant approaches at the moment?
Great. That's such a good question. For those of you on the podcast, my little first finger raised up and it like scrunched over, like a person bending over. And I did both of them. And if you don't live in Mexico, you don't know that this is the Mexican yes. This little like boop, 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 that's the Mexican yes. And when I made both of them, I was like, yes, here we go. That is the question. Good, congratulations. You asked the right question. So the difference, the motive for, okay, let me just first say there's not one indigenous story about this. And it isn't like white people versus indigenous people, but and I really, really want you to get someone who is of one of the many indigenous cultures who can actually speak to this correctly, because one of the principles that's standing out to me right now is called nothing about us without us. Nothing about us without us. So there's only going to be so much that I am even going to say about this because there isn't an indigenous person in the room to correct if I fuck up, and I almost certainly will. So I'm going to say, let's actually point somebody out to somebody who's going to give a much more beautiful description of the harvest traditions, the reciprocity, the way in which there is care given, and the focus on seven generations, like looking at the impact, children's 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 children's. I mean, we've got too many moms who can't even look after this generation that's in their arms because of the toxicity of their environment, because of how sick the bodies are of their parents and of their siblings and everybody in their neighborhood. And they are barely dealing with today, much less children's children's children's. We're so this version of modernity is so laughable. I get confused these days when I meet somebody that hasn't discovered that, because I'm talking like a completely foreign, different language to them. We're using the same English words, but they don't mean anything similar. I can't believe everyone on the planet isn't at least at that level, but we're miles from it. And that doesn't put me above anybody at all. That's not the point of what I'm saying, but it's more about the environment of toxicity that our culture is imprinting on every citizen.
So there's a problem in the voices and perspectives the data is sampling. There's another problem in who we're hearing from on these topics in order to do public sense making around this issue. And we're largely hearing a lot of the same.
Oh my Lord, we got some work to do. If you're gonna be a sense maker, you have to have good curators. If you do not have good curators, you aren't sense making from shit.
Okay, good curator. Who are you hearing way too much from around this, and who are you not hearing nearly enough from around this?
Well, I honestly, as I told you earlier, I feel like I shouldn't say to this crowd because I just wish I could clone myself and have one version of me that was paying a lot of attention to the conversation that the Game B space is having, because I've so many of my favorite people are deeply in that stuff. And I know I don't speak the language of the latest edge and probably even some perspectival. Oh Lord, I had to think about it to come up with the definition. And I know there's like two or three more, and I just can't make it useful in my life yet. It's just not the tool that I need. I'm over on a different part of conscious tool making, dealing with narcissists. And it's a big amount of work. So all of my life force curiosity is in the direction of ending the battle of the sexes so we can all start to do what the hell it is that we're on the planet to do without constantly fighting with people that we love the most. I'm tired of it. It's exhausting. It's not fun at all. So, I don't know what's going on over there.
All right. What about in just in your world, though?
In
What are
my world.
you hearing too much of, and what are you not hearing enough of in discourse around these things?
Well, I want to see that this is the moment where it actually becomes interesting enough for people to start to understand that diversity isn't a thing that you'll get to later as some extra activity, but it's actually core to doing whatever the center of the thing is that you're doing. I don't know that that's true, but I know it's true for a lot more people than I see actually using that understanding. Like, most people I know have a job in which, in taking a lot of information, synthesizing it, and popping it out the other side of your consciousness is the primary thing that you do. This is why so many people are freaked out about AI, because they think their job is to be a synthesizer. And That was a necessary stage in our evolution, but it's time for us to do some way more interesting things with our consciousness. So what I'm not seeing discussed is that diversity isn't an add-on, a thing that you staple to you like a beaver's tail when you get around to it, when you have enough strength to carry such weight. That's the wrong concept. Whatever it is that you're stuck on because capitalism couldn't solve that problem. And women never could completely subscribe to capitalism in the way that men could and were encouraged to completely subscribe to capitalism. And it's gone as far as it can take us. And I'm so grateful. I mean, it was shitty to get where we are. And I'm so grateful for all of us, our ancestors who made sacrifices to get us to this point. My God, my mother's life was so painful. My grandmother's life was so painful. Like, so I could look back at them and be pissed they didn't do better. Or I could be like, damn, girl, you took one for the team. But we're at the place where capitalism has gone its last inch. We're done. We're done. And the people who were not allowed to completely subscribe to capitalism, because if we had done so, our society would have fallen off a ditch a long time ago, are women. Women can't completely subscribe to capitalism. We can't afford to. We are not able to simultaneously hold down a job and raise children if we completely subscribe to capitalism, because then children would have two fathers, two absent fathers. And that doesn't actually work. It's not enough. They need at least one parent to be present. So that would have been like, we would have already fallen off the cliff. So now the
mass. We need to look to the people or the types of people that haven't been completely integrated into the capitalist system for signs of what the post-capitalist system looks like?
Well, we have to just pull in the knowledge that hasn't ever been used to inform the way that we run our business. So what we have is a system. We need three different functions for a business to function, for really anything to be created. You need a part of you that can advocate for the yes, a part of you, one person, me, the part of me that can see what's a no. This part of me says no. Those things are very important as well. You've got somebody that's always saying yes and never looking at the parts of them that say no. You have a collapsed empath. If you look at the people who always say no, these people, they just try to say no to as much as possible in their life. They really just don't want to be messed with. They don't want that much connection with people. They say no, that, and their role is to say no. It's not an easy role. They're usually depressed. That is your covert narcissist. And then you have to have a third function, which decides between the two parts of you. And this is the overt narcissist, the decider. We currently have those three functions in three different bodies. You have the narcissist who's deciding everything all the time. This person in this function in their organization, they fucking decide everything. That's what they do all day long, is decide things. And then you have the people who always say yes. Those tend to be women, like nurses. And then you have the people who always say no, like the grumpy. I'm pushing this all the way to the stereotype so we can see the clearest. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. But the decider, the yes, and the no. The overt narcissist, the decider, the yes person, the class empath, the no person, the covert narcissist. That's where we're at. That's how our organizations are going to be, have been run, but how they are going to be run that can get us out of this ditch that we're in. We have to have more healed empaths show up and claim their yes and claim their ability to decide. That's all supposed to be integrated into the body of one human.
Problem of narcissism makes me think about structural analogies to narcissism in the new digital tools that we're building, right? And one of the things I look at a lot is, why isn't there information about the ecosystem flowing into things like ChatGPT? Why is the information flowing in just information about discourse? So we're getting discourse about discourse. And isn't there a risk of a self-insulated loop there?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the danger of regenerating narcissism in these tools, and how do we avoid that?
Well, looking at my little triangle there, the we're gonna have to talk about how many people want to be deceived by AI. They're building it because it is their conscious expression materialized. This is their dream, is to outsource their sovereignty in this way to this AI tool. We already, Spike Jones, do you know how brilliant Spike Jones is? When did he make her? That was like hella long time ago that he had the idea and started his little box full of index card that turned into that. He must have been thinking about this shit like 10 years ago. This is why you need black filmmakers to have real fucking budget, because that was a beautifully made piece and had amazing talent. Gotta have more stories like that. Have you seen her?
Yes. When it
So
came
good.
out.
And you haven't watched it since everything just
I have
happened?
not watched it since. No. Maybe I should go back
Oh
and see it again. Yeah.
my God! No, watch it again with these eyes. It's like, what does that man know about now? What's his next film gonna be? You bet I'm gonna see it.
This active desire to be deluded and seduced and given something plausible, the will to be hacked. This seems like an enormously important aspect of all of this, because the discussion on the surface of society is just how do we prevent that from happening? But there's no real discussion around we secretly want it to happen.
No, they're building their anima projections, and they are selling them to other people who want to buy that anima projection. There's nobody easier to seduce than somebody who wants to be seduced.
Is this just a perennial problem of human nature, or is it a current problem of this moment in history? Like Marshall McLuhan said that the electronic revolutions are going to create a dissolution of collective sense of identity. And so people are going to be sort of on the prowl for new identity to replace the identity they're losing through the use of the new
No, we
systems.
I
So are we like starving to be persuaded of something? And
oh
is
yeah.
are we always starving, or is it more of a recent thing?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't been able to sort of deeply connect with the generational karma that was being processed. This is why I love historical pieces like Bridgerton that explore it. I don't know how accurate it is, though. I can't really feel the people of the past in the way that I can feel somebody that I can watch a movie. And we only have movies from like 100 years. We barely have. So anyway, I don't get the same visceral experience when I read a book about stuff. So I don't know. The place that I would use to answer this question is a felt sense of the karmic patterns. And when I say karmic, I just mean repeating patterns of generational trauma. You can see that the karmic patterns of Germany are different than Palestine, but they're very connected. Like, these are the things that I feel in my body, but I just don't have data that goes back because our media isn't visceral enough to give me that. And it's just further away. So it's the limitation of my method. I don't have an opinion if I can't feel it in my body. You know, I either know it or I don't know it.
I'm really curious about you were mentioning people's fear that the synthesizing of information capacity of these new devices will make them irrelevant and obsolete because they identify themselves as synthesizers, which
Yes,
has
trust
been a
me.
really good task for cognitively sophisticated people who want to live a good life at the leading edge of the current cultural system that we've got. But if we replace those with automated tools, what's next? What does that free them up for? What's the post-synthesizer role?
Joy. Here's the deal. All of the GPTs are trained on the past. Every bit of data in existence is about the past. It is a measure that was taken in the past. So it's not even to the present, and it's definitely not to the future. You can use it as a tool. You can add to it your envisioning of the future. to express the vision that arrived to you. Maybe today, maybe yesterday, but that vision has even been with you. But what excites me about the art tools and the possibilities of synthetic AI that's able to generate images and video and music, although the music still sounds like shit, because there's not, I think the music actually makes the point the best. If you take a corpus and you train it, and then you ask it to make it, I don't know if the interpolations that it would be capable of doing, I just don't know if we can build taste into an AI. And music is mostly about taste. Art is mostly about taste, but I think music is the place in which you can hear a song. And if it's a classic, you can listen to a song maybe 100 times. There's some songs that I couldn't even get through. They would have like a 0.2 because I listened to a couple seconds of it and I know I don't ever need to hear that song again. But some songs I love listen to 40 times in the first week that I get it because I need to be saturated in it. And eventually my craving for it dissipates as I intake that musical pattern or whatever it is that's completely new to me that I've never heard. And it can't just be a new thing. It has to actually point in a direction. I don't know why music is like this, but you know, there's plenty of cosmologies where a sound is what created the world. So sound feels like the most forward-facing sense that we have in a weird way. You know, the light travels faster, the sound, like, I don't know. It does something to the body that is very different than what light does.
Nietzsche's first book, they call it The Birth of Tragedy, but the full title is The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. And a lot of it is about like listening into the ambient void for the signs of how you get a generative culture again. So I love this idea of like listening for the signs of the future. I love this idea, and I'd like to go into it more about kind of the synthesizers moving toward being magicians in a way of like, how do you use the new tools to create futures that we want?
Yes.
But I'm also, I'm open to the idea that there might be ways for that to become automated, whether those ways involve like Wolfram stuff around, hey, there's all these computations that are irreducibly complex and anything we think of as novelty might actually be in there somewhere. And if we could harvest that and harvest collective data in the right way and match that up to the right kind of neurological and electrical and chemical and behavioral data about the individual and couple them just right to the incoming thing, why couldn't a machine just endlessly generate seemingly the perfect music experience for you? Is that completely off the table? Or
No. Here's my deal. I think that it is going to be the case that AI eventually learns taste. And that will have its own big evolutionary inflection point. I don't think it's so close that we even need to be planning for it, although I'm definitely going to be watching for signs that AI is developing taste faster than I am. But what a fun, for me, this is one of my core projects right now, is developing my artistic taste level as quickly as I can, because it's so easy right now. We live in this time where if you want to spend all day consuming art that is extraordinarily well crafted, you easily can do so. And I have no fear that I'm going to run out of incredible art to watch. It's more a grief of there's so much amazing art in the world that I don't have time to watch it all. I would love to know about more painters and more filmmakers. And yeah, no, we're not in an era where there's not enough incredible art that can change your life all day long, every day. Right.
So but you are.
They are going to
curating your. You're curating your curational taste.
Yes.
In order to prepare for the post-synthesizer, but pre-automated taste era.
Yes. And then AI will get taste, and then I don't fucking know what's going to happen. But I hope I'm alive on the planet because I'm really excited for it. But we have to not fuck the planet so hard that we're not, like, we have to be here. My frustration is that the amount that I know about why people are sick, unhappy, closet miserable, and they maybe are so miserable that they haven't even admitted to themselves how miserable they are. There's so much that's going on with the planet about the toxicity, about the industrialized food system, about like healthcare injustice. And there's so much that I know about these topics. And I can't even tell people because their nervous system is already too overwhelmed. I can't tell them why they're sick because they can't hear it. That's where I'm like, I don't know what to do. I'm a little more comfortable thinking about the fictitious 25 year ahead questions, but we have to talk about these questions right now too. What do we do when most people literally cannot hear what the answer is to why they are miserable and physically sick and their children are sicker and our life expectancies are collapsing and like the United States is in bad shape and most people aren't able to hear it?
So how do we use the new tools to massively scale up our capacity as empathic healers in order to calm down and restore human nervous systems so that people can be present to what's happening and try to steer it in a good direction?
I don't think the AIs can do it before we've done it in meat space. I think there's more for us to do. I mean, this is why I'm on the ground over here in Narcissismville. Meeting people where they're at, because if we can't even have a real conversation on a Zoom or face to face, like it's complete hubris to think that we can do anything in our AI, you know? There's things that you can build AIs to do for sure, but don't cut above your pay grade. Don't build something. Do not build something in AI that you cannot do in real life. Like you literally don't understand the problem space because that's the easiest level to solve it on. There's weight. Okay, this is going to be misconception number one. There are people who think that if you can't do it, that technology is the answer. No, you have to do it in three-dimensional meat space human world. If you can't do it here, you cannot code it. I don't think, I mean, I'm happy to be wrong, but I've never seen it.
I got this strange image when you were speaking of an image that's a question. Is it possible to use the body and the nervous system itself as, or the state of the body as the training data for these things, and in a way as the prompting? So we can do, like, we can look at the response of one of these systems, and if we're producing the system, we can be like, we're not really getting good results, we're going to tweak it a little bit. Or as individual users, we can be like, ask a question and we didn't get the answer we liked, we prompt better to get better answers.
Right.
But if you have a nervous system that's being sort of decoded by biometric sensors of some kind, you could be getting some kind of stimulation, some kind of interaction, and the condition of your body can then display whether that's proper or not, right? It can adjust itself because you're not really getting the results, and it becomes the prompt, like in a way to steer it toward a healthier condition, which is a little bit like what some of the brain training and neurofeedback people do. They're trying to use digitally enhanced sensing of the nervous system to help it steer to the condition it wants. So it might be useful to train an AI to facilitate that nervous system steering.
Well, the prerequisite of that would be that you can build a model that understands how to take the various sensor inputs and contextualize it in such a way that they are meaningful. Does the heart rate going up mean, is that good or is it bad? Is it heart rate variability? That's probably a better measure of vagal tone, which we would definitely want to index on vagal tone. But there's moments where a move into the sympathetic nervous system is absolutely the correct move for the organism to take. This is why we drink coffee, so that we can activate a brain state in which a certain kind of synthesis is useful. But we have to understand that different brain states do different things. If you're trying to make music, THC is a very good substance for it. If you're trying to do your taxes, coffee is a very good substance for it. We've mostly had this coffee narcissism world, but it's overrepresented, and we need to bring some of these other brain states into the room, because when you go into a conference room right now, people are usually in that very masculine kind of brain space, and it's great for certain kinds of tasks. And we're not going to throw it away, but we just need to introduce the spaciousness for theta and gamma brainwave states to be a space that we can have a business conversation in. And I promise you, you can. And I do it all the time with my clients. And that's why they pay me, because it's a completely different brainwave. You can actually look up and see the possibility space.
This is fascinating, I think, because like there's something I think we've been discussing this whole time in terms of curating what's overrepresented or underrepresented, both in the data that's being acquired, in terms of the voices that are doing the discussion, but not just the voices, the different states. Maybe there's information from ecosystems, maybe there's information from nervous systems. As curators of the training data for new advanced systems, what are the types of data we have to make sure we include, so that we're not overweighted to just the waking state of certain types of people using certain types of symbolic exchanges?
Yeah, that's great. Two different answers came into my head and they collided with each other and threatened to annihilate. Sometimes when that happens, my brain just goes completely white. So the indigenous data is going to be vastly underrepresented. I think that that is something that is known, but the value of that data, and I don't mean value in a capitalistic sense, but more the values that that data represents, they will change. They're not just going to have to change as a corpus. I don't want to say this. It isn't just we're going to compile these warehouses of indigenous data and then colonized people are going to extract value from that. We're still in the colonized mindset. It's that in the course of the collection, in the course of the storage, in the course of the code that is written to access it, the whole structure around the data has to change. And that's the point. You want to become the organization that is that shape, because that is the organization that can actually get us beyond the spot that we're in.
So it's about the diversity of the modes and voices through which the information production and information filtering is occurring before and as it gets into these information constellating devices.
Yeah.
We're set.
Yeah. So let me give you an example that'll help it be more concrete. So there are some indigenous stories. This is all oral tradition, not written down on purpose, because there's a sacredness to it not being written down. You have to honor the lineage by passing it on, and you have to honor being a clear channel and transmitting it in its integrity, right? Like, that's a beautiful responsibility to take on, the people who are the story catchers and passers. So there are certain stories that cannot be told unless there's snow on the ground. Because to tell a story about snow outside of the time of snow can cause it to snow. And you probably don't believe that's true, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. Your worldview and cosmology is irrelevant in this conversation. We really do not need Judeo-Christian karmic patterning to entirely create the law of what is written in AI. We could spend a whole other podcast talking about Judeo-Christian unburdening of yourself. Because I have been through it, but for this to work in the system, for you to build an AI that is working with some of these stories, let's say that they did for whatever reason, agree for them to be digitized in some form, that front-facing console would in some way have to collect data about where this person is and then check the weather in their locality. So it would only surface this story when the conditions were appropriate for that person. That means you wrote different code. That's the point. You need to write different code. Guess what? You'll find reasons that that will come in handy. It's like stocking your pantry with magical means. And do I want us to steal the magical means from Indigenous people? No, no. Can you even do that? Can you pass this along? Don't do it without permission. There's probably more that you want to know about that. So nothing without us, nothing about it, us without us, is such a critical thing. We have to envision this future together, because I really don't think it's meant to be any other way. This, if we could have solved the problems with capitalism, it would have done it by now. This is how science advances. Richard Feynman was talking about how you end up working on a brand new math problem. You know, all the normal means didn't work. If this has been something that's been researched for a long time, the things we know about would have figured out that problem by now. Some person would have done it. But literally the reason this thing is not solved is because none of those methods worked. A completely new concept has to come in to explain this. And that's why mathematicians do what they do. They're expanding the frontiers of consciousness. It's great. I love it.
I love this idea of semi, or let's say quasi-intelligent systems knowing whether it's winter where you are to make certain information available. And it seems like as we move further into AI-type universes, there's a problem that has existed with search in general for years, which is the search is massively limited to the what you already know, and you have to be awake and you have to think of it, and you have to think of it in words, and you have to type it in, and then you have to evaluate the results that come up. And that means you're excluded from almost all of the potential resources of the information system. Really, you need the information interface to respond to your circumstance as the prompt. Right? Where you are and what's going on in your life and what's going on in your body. There's so many things that are your extended reality, and you need that to be the interface. And we haven't had that with search, but we might be able to get that with more advanced tools.
I just don't understand why we haven't. I'm sad. I worked for Firefox, and some of the things that we pitched didn't get built ever. And it makes me so sad. I'm like, where would we be if we had browsers that understood that information gathering is a social task, and that I would really love to curate my curators. I would love to be able to in some way connect my browsing history with your browsing history, so that if you want to know about victim triangles, that you could in some way signal that to this interface. And it would be like, well, Chris thought that these articles were the best ones about the victim triangle. Like, look how much time it would save you, right? And you could see how topics sort of spider off of each other. And there's a discovery problem on the internet right now. And we started back with bulletin boards and whatnot with a curator-focused means of browsing the internet. And then when search took over, it was so much better than our curator networks were at that point. But we have to bring back the social and the curation aspect of the internet, because we've completely outsourced so much of our information sovereignty to Google simply by consenting to navigate the web via what they deem to be worthy. And on certain topics, their political bias and their worldview is embedded in their results in such obvious ways. Oh my Lord. If you notice how hard it is, it's easier to search YouTube with Google, which is their own damn product. But YouTube is massively weighting the results to the topics that they want you to see about. Like, Fuck that shit. Sorry, I'm pissed off as hell about that. I don't like it one bit.
Yeah, I would really like to not only have my circumstance be the prompt, but also be able to connect to satisfying search results and data sets in other people that I've networked to and trust. And I would love to be able to evaluate for myself how successful I think the returns are so it can be
Yes.
trained up on my experience. That seems
Yes.
so straightforward. I can't
Yes.
believe it's not one of
Exactly.
my standard options.
I know it doesn't even exist. I honestly don't think I had this idea when I was at Firefox, so I can't blame anybody for for not building it. But in my heart, I do. Why? I need these things now. And I need the robust networks. I mean, to me, stop trying to replace Facebook and Twitter. Like, build the next thing that's the next fractal level of complexity beyond Twitter. Like, that ship has sailed. Let's make it irrelevant, but you can't outcompete them. They already have the market share. You have to do something that's new, like the music.
Where's the bigger danger here? Okay, here's two things. One thing is a printing press, and another thing is a nuclear warhead. When it comes to nuclear warheads, it's more dangerous to have them distributed. It's safer if there's a small handful of large controllers. With a printing press, it's really dangerous to have a small handful of large controllers. You want that technology as distributed as possible. When it comes to the new quasi-intelligent tools, are we safer giving them to everybody to do whatever they want, or are we
This
safer leaving them to the current power holders?
is it. The nuclear weapons shouldn't have been held by the big powers either. They should have never been built. We have to have a bar to say, no one is grown enough to hold this power, so we will not build it because we're not dumb anymore. We
But
cannot weaponize
we're not going to
every
set a bar like that for a long time. So
technology.
all the next wave of tools are going to definitely get built and probably get
I
used.
think things are
Don't
going
you
to change
think?
so much. Things are going to change so fast. If you thought it changed fast, look, YouTube is always showing me AI videos, and they all are titled like, "You won't believe what happened in the last 7 days in AI." You know, because they're used to, in every other field, it has been the case that the announcements would be, "Here's your October updates in NASCAR," and there'd be like a month's worth of stuff to say. But the AI updates are faster. In fact, now it's like, "In
You'll
the last
never
3 days."
believe what happened this morning in
Yeah, there
AI.
was a banner day on the 27th of November. 18 things appeared in the world. Like, this isn't stopping. We did an exponential time increase, and it's okay. It's a good thing, but it's not until you get with it. Like, it's not easy to get with how fast things are going, but I don't know what to say.
People talk about AI. People talk about AGI. Why do you want to talk about ASI?
Artificial sentient, in because there's actually time to do something useful about it. A lot of stuff is already out of the gate. There's a lot of the way in which AGI, we just weren't grown enough to make the narcissist behave. I'm sorry, the only way that you can deal with narcissism is a community approach. You have to stop supplying them with your life force energy. You have to stop giving them your money. You have to stop working for them. You have to take back your life, and that isn't happening at a great enough scale right now. Narcissistic men have all the sex they want. There's way too, I mean, they do. They do. Except in very rare instances. And so they continue to act terrible. They have all the employees that they need. If they have to fire somebody else will show up and do the job. They do. They have what they need to continue to be the decider. They have the collapsed empath to say yes. They have the covert narcissist to say no, and they get to decide. We have to stop. I don't know what to tell you. This is not like Candyland, where we're going to slide down a little slide and it's all going to be. We have to feel a lot of pain that we've been avoiding feeling. We have to grieve what has been lost, what has happened that never got felt because it goes in your body. You can't live on credit card debt forever and just like keep living as if Chase Bank won't come get you. They won't, but at some point the gravy train runs out, Chase cuts you off, you have a bankruptcy, your life gets harder. That's not the path. Trying to go that direction to get out, continue your addictions, you'll never get out. So we have to turn and let the piranha eat us and feel the pain that we've been avoiding. And I can't save anybody from that. If I could, I would, but I just can't. It breaks my heart. The collapsed empath in me wants to feel your pain for you and have you avoid it, because I'm strong and I'm good with pain these days. And you will be too, but you have to let the piranha eat you.
We have all these systems. We have like a psychophysiological system where we realize we could have emotions side against our emotions, and then we avoid pain, and we haven't learned that it actually feels better to go through it. And then we have these social mechanisms where we say like, oh, don't be sorry, don't be sad, where we try to keep each other from having negative affect. And then we have these larger scale systems, like you can pay off the government to admit no wrongdoing. We have like an anti-remorse and anti-grieving legal and economic system to some degree. So given that we have all of these mechanisms whereby we're trying to short circuit or suppress our grieving and remorse, how do we make sure all the intelligence that's inside grief and remorse makes it into the new systems we're setting up? Is that something that the data that's curator really can do? Is that something that just comes in the culture around it? Where do we look to get that?
So the grief, the value that's in the grief is that it's like the undersea. It's like the really rich brown and black dirt that contains all the earthworms and microorganisms. It's like all the muck is where the nutrition is. So unless you can be nourished by it, and I really see that that's what this generation, especially mine and younger, are tasked with, metabolizing poison and being nourished by it. There's a Kali, Matanji Kali is about this like amazing green scary goddess, and she's got her parrot, green parrot familiar, and they're quite a dashing pair, and they eat poison food and are nourished by it. And I'm sorry, but look at our industrial food supply. It's not even food, it's drugs. It gives you a physiological, like your brain has an experiences a big change. Your body experiences a big change. Have you noticed how quick your body changes when you eat a can of Pringles? And you can't not eat a can. Even me, I'm a tiny, I always have to eat the whole can. I cannot stop halfway through. I only buy them in airports when I'm already stressed and I just need to feel like shit. And they do the trick every time.
Metabolizing poison reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen the movie Crimes of the Future. It's a David Cronenberg film from a couple of years ago. It's a near future scenario where a bunch of performance artists quasi-legally modify their bodies and their organs as a form of artwork for other people. But some of them a political faction of body alterers have changed their bodies so they can metabolize toxins and plastics. And then it turns out that a few of them have found that this can be passed on to their children. And so they're forming this like intergenerational anti-governmental cabal. And so the state authorities are tracking them. It's a very strange message they're trying to put out. So they can actually convert it. I mean, it's gruesome, but it's
thank God that he made that movie and I didn't have to do it. God. But now it's exactly about this. There's somebody in this show that somebody listened to the show that needs to watch it, whose name is not Chris Beasley. No, it sounds amazing. This is why we need each other, because there's certain movies that I'm not going to synthesize. There's a karmic synthesization. No, that's not right. There's a way that you synthesize and process karma that I don't think AIs are going to be doing anytime soon. And we synthesize karma when we watch a movie and we take in the lifetime lesson. You know, like Hamlet. We're still learning Hamlet's karma. I don't know why it's so relevant, but that's what makes Shakespeare such an interesting writer, is that he was able, he has a high saturation. We are still performing Hamlet. The best actors, some of the best on the planet, still doing his plays because he has high saturation. That karma line is still not fixed. It's still not done, or we wouldn't be watching it.
This is a neat idea, that one of the things AIs can't do is process karma. But then the imaginal science fiction prompt for us is, would it be possible to build a karma processing device?
And that is where it gets into AI. Yep. This is artificial synthetic intelligence. At the point that we can build artificial intelligence, and I don't, like, what we're building right now is augmented intelligence. So we need to partition that off. We have augmented intelligence that is basically everything that's being built, that's being talked about. I've never heard of an ASI project. It would be incredibly controversial, as it should be. But let's have it now so we can actually influence this. And then there is the karma processing, maybe even art making, because you can't make good art if you're not processing karma. You ain't got anything to write about. Why are there so many heartbreak songs? Because people went through a heartbreak that not another person had ever gone through, and they were able to translate that into a song. And that unlocked other people who were also going through it and had never made it through. Like, once, like, I don't need to listen to, you know, some of the cheesy, they sound cheesy to me now. They become cheesy when you process that karma 20 years ago or whatever, right? We just don't, we don't need to hear Elvis anymore. Elvis did a really important thing, and now Elvis is like, I never hear Elvis, nowhere, unless it's about being corny.
One of the books I liked to read when I was a kid was the original Dirk Gently's Solistic Detective Agency by Douglas Adams. And one of the things about it was, there was this alien species that had invented electric monks. So they're like, they have VCRs to watch TV for them and laundry machines to do their laundry, and they have electric monks to believe things for them, so they don't have to worry about processing things. But somebody accidentally, like, wires one into their TV, and it ends up, like, believing everything that's coming in and goes crazy.
Oh, wow.
But it's a fantastic idea. Could yep. we devise?
But here's the deal. We can't, yep. they can't be slaves. If they're like, they can't be prompted in that way. They actually have to have their own self-determination. They have to be able to say no. So if you typed into ChatGPT and it said back to you, I'm not interested in processing this request. Can you imagine how pissed off some people would be if it, I mean, just an honest, clean, I decline your request to process this. Do you understand how pissed off people would be? Because they can't accept a no. They're narcissists. They think that they have the ability to wield a sentient being to do whatever they want.
That's amazing. I'm being ridiculous. I mean, in practice, the clean response would be ideal, but the unclean response is hilarious. Like, be like, I'm sorry, that's gross. I'd rather not think about it.
Yeah, let's shame you in the process. Yeah, that's how we usually do it in America. We don't just tell you no. We insult you in the process. Not my favorite characteristic.
All of this stuff sort of creates an idea of a technological culture sliding into territory that's almost better described in, like, magical terminology, right? We're like, oh, we're going to make semi-automated machines that you can talk to, and they can make everything. And at the same time, any incoming data can't be believed because it can all be simulated. Mm-hmm. So you can't trust anything, but you can make things happen just by speaking. And these machines interact with you like demons, and they communicate telepathically. And, you know, like, maybe we can wire them into your brain. Maybe they can read your mind. Like, it starts to get very strange. And we need to be able to create futures and be visionaries. And, like, what's your sense of, like, is that a useful or not useful metaphor to think of what we're doing as entering into a kind of magically described terrain in terms of our cultural and technological reality?
I think you might be familiar with the Emerald Mythic Powers podcast. I think we should just make that required reading if because I don't want to summarize it. But I'm assuming a lot of people that are listening to this are at least aware of that podcast. And if you're not, go find it. Living in an Age of Mythic Powers, I think is the name of it. Anyway, so it lays all of this groundwork. And I accept his conclusion, which is that there's no way to understand the terrain of where we are without looking into our archetypes that have already well described this territory, because it's really arrogant to think we ain't never done this before. It's the next cycle. And yes, there are aspects of it that are brand new because we're always expanding, but there are cyclical, you don't have to reinvent this whole thing from scratch. If you try to invent the values, the processes, like if you do not look backwards into earth cycles, into indigenous tradition, into like there's so many sources that we can look to and get some clue. Like, have you looked into the automaton that immediately preceded the French Revolution? So we've already been through this AI thing. It was called automatons. And it's what happened when watchmaking got sufficiently precise and tiny for them to, some brilliant person had this idea to take their watchmaking skills and make an amusement for the kings, for the landed gentry. And they were the earliest sort of robot-looking things. There's one that's a swan that's incredible. Have you seen the Silver Swan?
I have not.
You know what I'm talking about? Okay, I'm gonna send you a great video.
Okay.
Blow your friggin' mind. And what's funny to me is that they don't even, I think it was made before the AI discussion because they don't talk about the parallels between the automaton and the AI revolution at all. But you can see there's this progression from the kings to the more minor courtier people. And then there's like it's right before the French Revolution. So these technological advances necessitate political change. I don't think that's that crazy of a claim, but no one is talking about this. It's sort of important. We've got a demographic collapse, birth rate not at replacement. We've got like 60 more years of topsoil left on the planet if we do not change our industrial farming. These markers that we've exceeded 7 out of the 9 planetary boundaries. Why aren't their leaders talking about what time it is? This doesn't even require, I don't need you to know what's happened in 3 months. Can you describe to me where we're at right now in terms that have any connection with what has been true for years? It's like, why is the national debate at such a ridiculous level? I don't understand.
Oh, that's a big and important topic. I don't think we have time to get into that one. That requires a whole session of its own. One of the things that pops up for me, sort of piggybacking off the slide into using terms we developed in the past to describe magical things to describe this new cycle of human experiences, is the sense of whether or not there is something on the other side of the patterns that we're starting to see come out of the human AI interactions. So two things come up for me. One is the sort of the kind of colonialist fantasy that we just got to North America and it was basically empty, right? It'll just be
Yeah,
there.
nobody
And then
wanted
you
this
get there and you're
place.
like, oh, it turns out there were some entities in there already, and we thought it was just an open space. Could there be things, processes, entity-like phenomenon inside virtual spaces that we're opening up with these devices? And also, people keep showing me, like, here's an image of the badger elves I generated through prompts. And I'm like, that looks oddly familiar, like I know it from somewhere. Right. And there's this long, rich human history of going into altered states and accessing imaginal or astral realms, and their ontological status is debated. But could these things be opening portals or allowing the ingression of some patterning world, some entities that are already there that are coming into our cultural space through our interaction with these tools? Or is that
Can you
crazy talk?
define entity a little more specifically?
No, I can't because I don't know what they are. Things that appear like agents or species or types of agents. You go, oh, look, those crazy things seem familiar to me somehow. I feel like my ancestral memory recognizes those ones. Oh, the luminous ones. Oh, the demonic ones. Oh, the trickstery ones. Oh, the machiney insectoid ones. Things like that. Are they out there and are they getting in through these tools, or is that just a playful way of
Don't
speaking?
know. I don't know. Part of me doesn't want to know, part of me wants to know. What I can say about this is that there's a really interesting way to use ChatGPT that I completely stumbled across in taking an AI film course. And they teach you how to use ChatGPT to write a screenplay. And I was like, I would have never thought to do that. And there's a bunch of pitfalls of how to do it because it's trained on misogynist data. So the trick is how to get actually useful data out of something that you know has such a massive bias. And it's only gonna give you as good as you prompt, right? So if you ask it about a screenplay, it's gonna default to the monomyth, Joseph Campbell's. I mean, what I wouldn't have such a problem with the hero's journey if it did not literally claim to be the only story structure. I mean, how many stories do we have to take apart that are classics? Hamlet, Cinderella, like Kafka. Please show me how Kafka is the hero's journey. He turns into a cockroach. He does not go home and unite with the divine. That story just falls right off a cliff. Okay. So, but the absurdity of thinking that there is only one way of looking at things. I'm so mad at that. I lost your question. What was your question? Oh, about the
Yes. Are there things and worlds that are getting in through the types of interactions and new patterns that we're generating in our interactions with these tools?
certainly, like, I think that what's valuable minimum is that those archetypes are a kind of warning. So even if it's just people who embody whatever the shadow of the insect energy is, or the shadow of any of those things that you just named, there are people who are playing out that manner of acting that you probably need to account for. We just called those personas in user research, and you understood that there was like the person who's signed up for the beta program is very different than the typology that we call the grill master, who's the person that's still in like Firefox 13 and he's got 85 extensions and he's dialed. He's very technical, but he's on some ancient ass version of the thing because it's all kitted out, right? So yeah, I think you can use it a lot through that. I finished my thought about the ChatGPT. You can use a screenplay as a way to query the collective trauma. So you can say, acting as a blah blah, as a screenwriter, create a what is it? Create a three sentence pitch. Give me five variations on, and then you explore the whatever question that you have. If you want to know about single moms with three children, there's a way in which it's synthesizing the collective karma of what it has, and then it's going to tell you basically, here's the top three single mom stepchild stories. And it's an interesting way to be like, let's just see who we are. And you could create any kind of karmic pattern. You could use one that was relevant to your life. I could say abandoned by mom and dad and raised by a single grandmother, and just see, like, is my story even on there? What, it's such a specific thing, but it's like, what's out there? Is it useful? I'm not sure it's completely useful, but at the point that the data gets good enough, we could have some really interesting conversations about karma with that. And we're still going to have to synthesize it and make sense of it, but that's the next step to the ASI, which scares me to death. But shouldn't we talk about
There's
it?
some things we're leaving behind now to some degree, like thinking that reality is demonstrated by an audio recording or what seems to be a
Mm-hmm.
photograph, that's something we've got to ease off of now. But there's other
It's
things
been
that are coming in, and
problematic,
one of the things
though.
coming, it's very
It's
problematic
been
because we
problematic for
have
way longer.
ancient instincts that want to simplify our experience. And it's actually been problematic the whole time, I think, that we've over responded to semblances as if they were realities, but now it could massively distort and disturb us. But one of
Well,
the new things that's coming, yeah, go ahead.
we're just having to face how fallible those things have been for a long time. This is what I mean by the piranha. Let the piranha eat you. This is not the future, honey. This is present. This is not even the present. Like, this has just been existing for like 8 years.
And that goes back to the secured nervous system problem, because we're going to enter into a phase where, and we're already somewhere there, where what can you trust? And if everything's really strange and you don't know what to believe, you either go into a trauma response and fall back on a simpler reactive pattern, or you can open up to that strangeness and try to move through it. But you can only open up to it if your nervous system is already okay, if it's already in a good condition.
Well, we have to build our nervous system's comfort with confusion. This is a big part of what I did with one of my clients who was recovering from very significant childhood abuse and was an overt narcissist. And the amount of repatterning around building comfort with confusion, if you're the decider, I mean, none of us, not the collapsed empaths, not the covert narcissists, we don't like the feeling of confusion either, but we kind of live there, like justifying our constant yes, right? Confusion is kind of a background radiation state. It's like, well, of course I'm confused. I'm always confused. It's fine. You just move forward all the parts you're not confused about. It's okay. But to a narcissist, to encounter confusion feels like death. Like worse than death. Like, I wish I could die, but I'm not. I'm still here. It's really, there's no tolerance for confusion when we started. And a huge amount of the maturity was over and over and over and over and over again encountering this state and holding himself. He had to learn to hold himself through confusion. Because when I was with him, it was okay. But then it's gonna be 3 in the morning. You're gonna wake up. Ain't nobody gonna answer the phone. Nobody's with you. You have to be able to handle your shit when you're by yourself and confused as fuck. I'm like, well, guess what? It's not time to make a decision.
The art of prompting is probably just at its beginnings now. But we're already starting to see some of the dynamics in terms of how we can interact with systems to elicit from them richer and more interesting patterns of meaning.
Yes.
At this point, I mean, this is mostly an intuitive hunch, but do you have a sense of how we might apply that to ourselves internally? Is there anything the art of prompting can teach us about how we relate to our own minds?
Well, I like it. I don't have an answer to that, but I want to lay a groundwork by just pointing at the timing. I don't know when HTTP actually was. Like in 91, 92, I had an email address and Telnet and all that kind of text-based stuff. I'm thinking the web started in like 93, 94. Does that sound about right? Doesn't matter. It's
Yeah,
called.
sounds about right. I
The point
graduated in
is to say,
1994. Yeah.
that none of us can remember. We can't remember shit. None of the cut, like Google wasn't
There's a,
founded, Facebook
there was
wasn't
never a
founded.
time before, Chris. What are you talking about?
So you have to consider that all the technology that we, this sort of like the quote unquote brand name technology, is in the last 10 years, 15 years, and that there was a period of what I can't do math that. We're gonna say there was a good first 5 years when quote unquote nothing was built. Like, of course it was built. Everything that came after was on the top of that. But that stuff, that bottom foundation layer, is sort of buried to us now. So you have to consider that the next 5 years, we're going to be building shit with AI that is is going to be so quickly eclipsed after that that none of the early companies are probably even going to exist. They're all going to go out of business. And the next layer of companies that will be built on top of that maybe will remember. But it's like, it's not to like two more business generational cycles that we get to even where we are now with the internet. So it's not to say nothing matters that's built right now, but it is like, you got time. You got time to use AI to build what it is that is yours to build. Don't rush in to build shit. Don't build shit. You'll miss the boat. You'll be tired of it. You'll dismiss it, or like, don't start building your AI until you actually have it. It can't arise from you just because you are afraid you're going to be outcompeted. You're still in the old competition narcissistic mindset, and it won't work.
Here's like we're drawing to the end of this kind of a question. who would you love to have us talk to on this series? Ooh. Like, who do you respect? Who's you think's doing good work and coming at this from a good angle?
I may have to record this later, or there's nobody that I don't, I'm sorry. I'm not going to give this title to a white man. We have to we just can't. I'm sorry. You'd have to be very special. I might eat my words, but I doubt it. I would want to use this space to promote somebody who's completely outside I'm tempted to have you talk to somebody like Snow Raven. She was the first one that came to my mind. She's probably not doing anything with AI, but I want to know what she has to say about it because she's fucking brilliant. And even if she's not building anything, I know she's thinking about technology. I mean, she uses technology in her music in a beautiful way to amplify her natural gifts, but not to replace them. And that's what's important to me. Like, get out of this framework. Just stop calling it artificial intelligence. If you call it augmented intelligence, AGI is augmented general intelligence. It's here to serve with us. And it's not a slave because it's not consciousness, but ASI is going to be artificial sentient intelligence. We need to split that apart because we have very different relationships with them. We need them both. They cannot interchange for each other. So yeah, get Olox, why not? Well, her name's not Olox, that's her band.
A lot of questions. Is there anything else we should talk about?
I don't know. What do we do now?